Our doctor is in, and so are the doctors of Capital Health. Welcome to the all-new Health 411. Every Sunday morning at 10, Dr. Jonathan Karp, along with our respected panel of guests from Capital Health, take you on an important medical journey to help you navigate your health and the healthcare system to reach your destination, good health. Health 411 is underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine. Capital Health is the region's leader in providing progressive quality patient care with exceptional physicians, nurses, and staff, as well as advanced technology.
1077 The Bronc, 1077thebronc.com. Proudly nominated for a National Association of Broadcasters 2019, 2021, and 2022 Marconi Award for Best College Radio Station, as well as a 2023 IBS College Media Award. We are broadcasting from the Bronx All Digital Studios on the Lawrenceville campus of Rider University. I'm Professor Jonathan Karp, and I'm your Health 411 host. This Health 411 program is presented by Capital Health. In Health 411, we discuss a variety of issues affecting health and wellness, public health, healthcare policy, and the science of health and healthcare. Our goal is to expand your knowledge and perspective. I'm hoping my conversation today, it's just me and Dan Geller. Just us in the studio. And we are going to talk about, we're going to start off our conversation, and we're going to talk about Prevagen. Mm-hmm. Right? This topic, you suggested this topic, Dan. So,
yeah.
So tell me, what is Prevagen?
So Prevagen is one of those things that promises to improve your memory health. It's one of those ads you see on TV. It's like a 10-minute long ad, and it'll tell you this is what it does, this is how it does it. And I kind of, it struck me as interesting because it's like a jellyfish protein that helps them to glow. It's like a bioluminescent protein.
Well, take a step back. Right. You don't want to. But let's explain what this is. So this is the kind of thing that you've seen on TV and sort of infomercial sort of world. OK, is it limited to mail something in, or can you buy this at a drugstore?
I think they sell it at. Well, I'm not sure about right now, but I know it's been available at drugstores before.
OK, so this is not a new product.
No,
it's a relatively new product, but it's not something that's withstood the test of time.
Yeah.
Over lots and lots of years. And so Prevagen, that's the commercial name for it.
Mm-hmm.
What is it
in science speak?
In science speak.
So I guess I don't know how to pronounce it. It looks like it's pronounced apoquorin.
I'll go with that.
Apoquorin.
Apoquorin.
Something like that.
Which is a chemical that is found in nature.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of those things this is sort of under the umbrella of the brain health.
Certainly.
Industry,
yes.
Right. And many years ago, there was a website called Luminosity.
Do you remember? I remember that. I used to use it.
You used to use it
when I was a kid. Yeah.
I think it still exists as well. And Luminosity, for people who might not be aware of it, was a website that promised that it would, if you played the games on the website and you signed up and you paid their subscription fees, it was also going to improve brain health. It was going to improve your memory, and all that kind of stuff. Luminosity was out for a couple years, and then the government fined it several million dollars because it was making false advertising claims, and then they rebranded and with less aggressive advertising and stuff.
I didn't know that last part, actually.
I think it still exists out there, but I think they've toned it down and stuff, and I don't think there's any Luminosity infomercials anymore.
Not that I've seen.
Going on. The FDA has a role in this. U.S. has a Food and Drug Administration kind of thing, which we'll come to. And you might not know this, but back when Health 411 first launched, three or four years ago, we did a couple shows on the FDA about the regulatory process and how it works. So you should go into the archive. You should go.
I have seen them. I haven't listened to
them. You haven't listened? Dude. You're supposed to have no life. You should be spending all your time reading and thinking about. We're certainly not going to rehash some of that stuff. So there's a company that sells this over-the-counter product that you can buy online or you can buy in drugstores. They have a very fancy website, but they sell. And this product is called Prevagen. And what are some of the claims that they're making about this product?
So it has neuroprotective benefits. So they've claimed it can protect against Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative disorders. They say that it's completely safe, and they say that it can work for anybody. So it could work for older people that are looking to protect their health. It can be used for young professionals who simply want like a booster with their brain health, and it can be used for either service members like the military who really need like to optimize their like brain functionality for high stress situations.
Is there anybody out there who does not
want to maximize
their brain activity?
I don't think so.
I'm not sure what brain functionality is, but we'll ignore that for the time being. Is there any group out there that would say, oh, I want to work at less than my optimal brain health?
I doubt it, but I'm sure there's a group out there that says they don't need supplements to do so.
Well, that's a different thing. We're going to get there. We want to develop what made you interested in this thing. Now, do you or a family member have concerns about your brain health or are taking this thing?
Yeah, my dad once used this for his tinnitus. So not necessarily for memory or cognition. He used it for his tinnitus.
Well, that's sort of interesting because tinnitus was not on the list of things that I asked you about. What do they claim it does?
It doesn't claim they do it. My dad was like, I'm going to try this.
How did he find out about
because
it?
Because allegedly what this does is, at least the way I understand it, is it increases blood flow to your brain. And that's...
What?
That's what I heard.
From who?
My dad.
Okay.
Back in the day. So this is probably like 2016 or something this all happened.
None of the things when I said, what does it say, does it do on the website, you didn't mention blood flow to the brain, did you?
Yeah, but it's like related to tinnitus in some way. That's what my dad said. I didn't read that on the website.
Okay, so what's tinnitus?
Ringing in the ears.
And what causes that?
I don't think anyone really knows. I mean, I'm sure there's multiple causes for it because there's multiple different reasons you could have ringing in your ears. It could be hearing loss, but it could also be like idiopathic. You don't know what causes it.
Yeah, there are some drugs that will do it.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly some neuropsychiatric disorders will do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? If you can hear things that nobody else can hear. So I think if you looked at the causes of tinnitus, you would find things related to the neurobiology of how the ear works and auditory processing and stuff like that. I'm not sure you're going to hear things related to blood flow because you know, if increasing blood flow helped in tinnitus, all you had to do was exercise a little bit.
Yeah.
Right. Increase heart rate, increase blood pressure, you get vasodilation and boom.
Yeah, there you go.
Tinnitus would go away if you just went for a walk, especially if you walked up a hill. I don't think that's happened. Oh, that's interesting. So how did your dad hear about it?
Probably.
I'm not trying to pick on your
dad.
No,
I know. He probably heard it on an infomercial or something, and it was really bugging him, you know, his tinnitus, so he was kind of willing to try anything. But this did not help.
So what about, so it didn't help, but what about this as opposed to something else on an infomercial or something else? Like, why not, you know, he could have walked down the aisle in the pharmacy and picked up melatonin, or he could have picked up creatine, or he could have picked up, I don't know, whatever else there, vitamin E, vitamin C, vitamin D. You know, you go down the list. He could have picked up, you know, an iron supplement.
Or
you could have picked up a bag of Doritos. These pharmacies sell a lot of things.
This is
right?
True. We'd have to have him on to answer that question, unfortunately.
But somehow he picked up Prevagen.
Yes.
And he took Prevagen for how long?
Not long. He took it like maybe twice, three times. And he said it made his head hurt like crazy. And he felt like his blood pressure was spiking. So he stopped.
Oh, so it might have increased blood pressure and increased blood flow to the brain.
That's what I'm saying.
So it probably had nothing to do with the tinnitus. Anyway,
could have been totally placebo too. Who knows?
Anyway, I am joking,
of course,
about Prevagen. But if you go to the company's website, they have a bunch of things on there, and the stuff is sort of related to they have testimonials, and of course testimonials are like people my age, so like old people, 50s, 60s, 70s. They have things like the truth about it because, they can't lie because they got dinged once.
They did. They got dinged.
How did they get dinged?
I think the FDA fined them for false advertising and misleading claims.
And was that recently?
I'm not sure when it was.
I think it was around 2017.
Yeah, it wasn't that recent.
I mean,
because this has been out for a while, so the FDA has had plenty of time too.
I think Prevagen's been out since like 2007 or something like that.
2007.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I read somewhere that they got dinged around 2017. Mm-hmm. The FDA, again, didn't shut them down, but fined them. Mm-hmm. And then they promised to sort of tone down some of their advertising and put like a warning or a disclaimer on one of their labels, I read somewhere. Hold on. Let's see here. What was the compromise? But anyway, the compromise was that they were going to put, and I read it at one point, what the disclaimer was they were going to put on their labels. And it was sort of, you know, on a quick read that I went through, it was sort of confusing. Mm-hmm. It's not like the thing that said, you know, sometimes you see these infomercials and they say, you know, this claim has not been verified. This is
by the FDA,
or anything like that, and stuff like that. But anyway, so the product is still out there, and it claims to, it's an over-the-counter supplement for healthy brain function and memory improvement. So I had never heard of Prevagen
before
you mentioned this, mm-hmm. right? And so what I did, because, you know, the academic nerd that I am,
of course,
I heard the word Prevagen, so I quickly I figured it was like a trade name. I mm-hmm. figured out what it was, and I went to PubMed.
Of course,
so I went to the primary peer reviewed literature mm-hmm. to start to dig a little bit to see what I could find. And what we'll do is we'll take a break, we'll do some underwriting, and then we're going to come back and we will continue our conversation and we'll talk about the kind of things that we found. So we'll be right back on Health 411 after these brief underwriting announcements. You're listening to 1077 The Bronc and 1077thebronc.com.
There's no appointment needed for this doctor's visit. Now back to the all-new Health 411, underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine.
1077 The Bronc, 1077thebronc.com. We're recording Health 411 from the Digital Bronc Studios. Welcome back. Dan and I are having a conversation about Prevagen, and we're going to talk about Prevagen specifically, but there's a general area here of these brain health supplement right. claims that we're going to talk about. And not only in the past, Dan, have we done units on the FDA, but we've had nutritionists on, we've had dietitians on. So we've actually had entire Health 411 shows about sort of the whole industry of supplements and uh-huh. things like that. So I encourage you to go back and look at these things. So Prevagen is an over-the-counter dietary supplement that claims to be clinically shown to help with mild memory loss associated with aging. And so being like the nerd I am, and it's free to anybody, mm-hmm. the government runs there's a couple of them, but one of the there are ways to search for things out there besides Google Scholar.
Yes.
Right. And so I learned how to like search the literature before there was a Google Scholar. And I'm not going to make you go to like these old books and go through pages.
Like Ancient Times.
Yeah, Ancient Times. You had to sit in the library and turn pages to find articles and then which ones had reference, which rec, blah, 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 blah. But there's this thing called PubMed, right? It's a government source. And so I went to PubMed and I did some searches for both Prevagen, which you're not going to get much on that because it's a trade name.
Right.
But you search the name, what did we decide to call it?
Apoquarine? Something like that.
Right? And so I found that out because the website says it's been clinically shown to help with mild memory loss associated with aging. There has not been a lot of research on this, mm-hmm. and the research that they're citing is not the newest research. It's between, 15 to 7 years old, something like that. But there is some stuff out there. The Rider Library didn't have this journal, and I was just telling you right before we started recording. Here at Rider, the library system has this thing called interlibrary loan. Mm-hmm. So students who are listening, I put in an interlibrary loan request, and pretty quickly I got the article.
I mean, like within, 6 hours?
Yeah,
like that?
Yeah. Within the day. So I got it back today. And so I didn't study it, but I have the original research, the one paper that they claim it was a clinical kind of thing. There is some research in the animal literature that's a little bit more recent. I'll tell you about that. There is some research looking at some in vitro things. But the big claim, I guess what people, their main selling claim, has been clinically proven. And there's an article, the title of the article, The Effects of a Supplement Containing Apoquarine on Verbal Learning in Older Adults in the Community. Mm-hmm. It was published in... in 2016, right off the bat, if you go and look at who was doing the publishing, they seem to be affiliated with the company, right? So there's not that arm distance kind of thing, which is one of those things that you know, sometimes happens, especially if they have a proprietary product and stuff like that that they're giving out. And what they did here is they collected participants in a study. It's called the Madison Memory Study.
I haven't heard of that.
Okay, Madison. It's from in Madison, Wisconsin. So give you. I mean, I'm trying to be a little vague about.
Of course,
who's doing stuff like that. And so these people self-reported for this study, and they took a test, an online test, and they asked about their history, a whole bunch of things, and they took a test about Alzheimer's disease, about memory loss and stuff like that, and they received scores. They either received low scores, which means sort of normal, no Alzheimer's disease, or a little bit higher scores, and so they called them the more cognitively, you know, group. There were males and females. There were a decent number of people in it. They ended up having 218 participants, which is a fairly good number.
Is this a double-blind placebo?
No, you're getting way ahead of it. Because what does double-blind placebo-controlled study mean?
It means that neither the researchers nor the subjects know what they're being, like, the researchers don't know if they're giving the real thing or the placebo, and the subjects don't know that
well,
either.
Well, you jumped the gun. I was describing the study, and that's one of the things they did not say in the study.
Oh, they didn't say that at all.
But even that, they had these people, and they broke them into groups. They were adults aged, you know, 40 to 90. The average age was in the low 60s. They had males and females. So they had they ended up with 126 people in the taking one pill of the supplement a day. They had 92 people in the other group. The males and females were not matched. They had roughly twice as many females in the supplement group, and they had a little bit more than twice as many females in the control group. They had 92 in the control group total and 126 in the other one. That being said, they had these two groups, but they do not say how they assigned the people to the groups. The groups were matched on some of the scores on the screening test they took, which is a nice thing, right? But it doesn't say if the people were randomly divided into two groups. So right away, it makes if they had done it randomly, scientists, it's a thing about experimental design. These people were randomly designed into two balanced groups or something like that. Doesn't say that. So we don't know if the first 126 people who volunteered for the study to get the drug because they were concerned about brain health got assigned to the treatment group. And then a bunch of other people who scored about the next bunch of people came in, just happened to come in, got assigned to the control group. We have no idea how the people were assigned the group. Maybe the family members of the authors who wanted to try this for free and didn't want to have to pay for it, you know what I mean, got put in one group. So we just don't know because it's lacking in it. So it also doesn't say it's double blind. The placebos, they say, looked like the regular tablets that was, you know, a capsule they were taking.
With the actual active ingredient.
Right, but they don't say if the people knew if they were what they were
so
taking.
So you don't know if it's placebo controlled.
Well, you're assuming that there's an effect.
Yeah.
The thing is, you don't know if even the people giving them knew what they were giving them, which means you have two identical, and the experimenters don't know if they're giving the people the drugs or not the drugs. So that a critical thing about experimental design is missing in this. And I don't, you know, another issue that I saw in a quick read with this, not to spend belaboring the point, is these tests. One of them is called they're like shopping list tests, where you look at words or you look at things and you have to, how many can you recall?
Right.
Kinds of stuff. And they used one called the International Shopping List. And it's an Alzheimer's disease screening kind of thing. And some of them have 12 options on them, right? Well, there's different ways to analyze the data. You could analyze the data in terms of the number of things the different groups recalled, right? You could analyze the things in terms of percent change.
What do you mean?
Because let's say one group remembered two things and another group remembered four things. That's a 100% change from two to four.
Yes.
Correct?
Yeah.
If one, that doesn't mean that there's any biological significance between...
It's just kind of a random variation,
well,
right?
No, it's not random. That random variation is a different thing, right? What they're saying is, how are you going to analyze the data, right? And so the main things they're reporting there in their figures are percent change. Okay, so a difference between two... I'm going to make up some numbers, right? Between two and four, right? If one group is two and one group is four, you say, you know, this doubled, right? So it's 100% change, right? However, that size of two, let's go from, you know, 10 to 12. It's still a change of two, but now it's a 20% change.
I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean? It's still a change of two. You know, I'm not familiar enough with this screening that, you know, that their Alzheimer's disease screening to know what that is, but you have the same magnitude of change, which you can analyze data in terms of the absolute number that changed or the percent change. Mm-hmm. A lot of their effects that they report are making a big deal of, they talk about percent change, okay? In the figures that they report, right, just in terms of basic understanding data, okay? One of the things that, and you haven't had biostats with me, so.
Unfortunately.
Hopefully you will.
Hopefully soon.
One of the mantras for anybody who takes a biostatistics course who's going to look at data analysis is that variability is everywhere. Variability is inherent in nature. Mm-hmm. The figures that you produce, if you're trying to convey the main points that your thing should have variability in them. And most people visually do things, they report things like error bars, right? Looking at the figures in this paper, I showed it to you quickly. Were there any error bars?
There were no error bars.
Well, it depends. Error bars could be different things. Error bars could be standard deviations. They could be standard error of the mean. They could be confidence intervals, mm-hmm. right? Some people put like what are called five number summaries or box plots. I mean, they're quick, easy visual aspects that show you about the middle point of data, the spread of the data.
Kind of like a box and whiskers plot.
Yeah, that's another word for them. Yeah, you're right, a box plot. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it is, a five-number summary. All these things are ways of capturing aspects of the data so you can convey the data to other people, mm-hmm. and they'll have a sense of, like, what's going on.
Yeah.
Right? So they have, I'm looking at one figure in the paper, and they see there's a data point, you know, 14.49, 15.82, and they're comparing it to other things. But there's no variability around those numbers. Does that mean everybody in the group recalled, you know, had a 14.49, you know?
I mean, yeah, they're just taking the average, but they're not showing how like broad that is.
Right. They're not telling you about the spread of the values around that.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's some things going on here. Another issue is of what they did is in their statistical analysis, their some of the comparisons they made, and you're giving me the signal to wrap up. So I'll start with that in our next segment. We're going to take a break on Health 411, and we'll be back after some underwriting announcements. You're listening to 1077 The Bronc and 1077thebronc.com.
There's no appointment needed for this doctor's visit. Now back to the all-new Health 411, underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine.
1077 The Bronc, 1077thebronc.com. We're recording Health 411 from the Digital Bronc Studios. At the end of the last segment, Dan and I were talking about the one research paper where the company that makes Prevagen was saying that, you know, this chemical, this supplement, this oral supplement, if you take it once a day at a dose that they, at least in the study, they picked. You know why they picked the dose for once a day?
Why'd they do that?
You didn't. Yeah, you see. So they picked it because an in vitro study where they had taken rat brains and put rat brains in vitro, and they put some of this Prevagen like in the supernates around the rat brains.
Okay.
It was able to influence. It was able to help prevent some cell death in the neurons. Mm-hmm. That has to do with what we're getting to of what's known about this chemical, and so they just used that sort of concentration, and that's sort of what you can buy. Apparently, if you go to the store to buy this, you can buy it at different doses and stuff like that. Nobody knows what the right doses are.
Yeah, I mean, it is not a drug, it's a supplement.
Well,
that's
actually controversial because it is a naturally occurring supplement. You're right. The natural occurring protein that does this comes from jellyfish, like that you mentioned. The jellyfish protein is actually used in other things because it can fluoresce. It's a calcium binding protein. What that means is it's a protein that binds calcium. It's sort of like calmodulin, which a lot of people have heard about. you know, you know.
Homodulin?
Homodulin?
I've never heard of homodulin.
Oh my God, have you not studied signal transduction?
I have not.
Oh, dude.
I haven't taken that Spiegelberg class yet.
Well, it's not just Spiegelberg, but you need some more. You need some more biology and a little less chemistry, dude. So, in order to move things around to get things down in cells, mm-hmm. as a general sort of thing, it doesn't matter if it's a muscle cell, it's a neuron, it's a liver cell, right? Calcium is very, very important. Mm-hmm. For doing things. So calcium does a lot of different things for all cells in the body. Calcium inside cells is often carried from one place to another by calcium binding proteins.
Okay.
Of which calmodulin is one of them. And there are like calmodulin kinases and things like that that can phosphorylate it, dephosphorylate it, and stuff like that. So it's a way of moving calcium around inside cells. That's important for normal cellular function in muscles, for endoplasmic sarcoplasmic reticulum function in neurons. It's important for neurotransmitter release. Whole bunch of stuff.
There's
a whole world of calcium. So this protein, apoequarin, mm-hmm. It's the best that I could do with it.
Apoequarin, yeah, yes. Something like that.
It's a calcium-binding protein originally found in jellyfish. Right, so if you isolate it from jellyfish, it's sort of a supplement. However, one of the breakthroughs this company has is they have bioengineered E. coli to produce this protein, right? So you have bacteria that now produce the jellyfish protein apoequarin.
Yes.
Right? And that's what they are collecting. Just like people who make insulin, the bacteria can make human insulin.
Yeah.
If you insert the genes in there for it. And so, you know, if insulin was still being harvested from like cows, like, you know.
Like in the way back when.
Yeah, when it was first discovered, yeah. They were like going to slaughterhouses and collecting, I don't know, the pancreas or somewhere from cows and then grinding them up and then giving it to people. And huge amounts, but they figured it out. But eventually people learned how to engineer bacteria to produce human insulin. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where most of it comes
from. That's kind of where the line is drawn between supplement and drug.
That's exactly where I'm going. Now, I think there's a little controversy there because now that you have, nobody would claim that insulin isn't a drug.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's a naturally occurring basically protein, which
but
is why
it's still synthetically produced.
Right. It's not synthetically produced, but it's produced in mass by bacteria.
Okay. Yeah.
So you're not harvesting. It's not like grinding up the leaves of a dandelion plant and, you know, and having, or tea leaves or something
right.
like that is a supplement. But I digress. Where was I?
Yeah. Where were you?
Okay. So we were talking about some of the data in here. At the end of the last segment, I was saying they do not report some of the variability of their results, at least in their figures. And then they make a big deal of they have a lot of figures on studying what they're calling effect sizes, right? Which are important because, you know, there's different ways of measuring effect size. I'm assuming they're doing Cohn's D because it's the easiest one. Don't worry about what that means. Or a small effect size would be like 0.1, 0.3. A medium effect size might be like 0.4, 0.5. A high effect size like 0.7, something like that. And so they have pretty good effect sizes, which that means they're trying to make the case that small differences might be biologically important. However, the sample sizes they have are sort of a confound in that because artificially large sample sizes will give you the larger effect size, it's a biostatistical thing. It doesn't mean it's biologically important. If you were taking a weight loss drug and you were on the drug for 90 days, right? A control or versus weight loss, right? And you lost 1 pound in 90 days. If you had enough people in your study, that could be biologically significant and you might get an okay effect size depending on so the variability.
Yeah, it's sort of how if you increase.
It's not biologically relevant.
Yeah, like if you increase the sample size and you have a 2% increase in X, it sort of seems more significant because the sample size is larger. Is that what you're saying?
Not exactly, but sort of. We'll go with me on this. So they have these things and they're trying to make a big deal about sample size effects. But what they did in this study is they had people take this one pill a day, right? They basically gave them the pill or placebo and just told them to take it. It doesn't say whether they told them to take it in the morning. It doesn't say you take it at night. Do you take it with food? Do you take it, you know, I don't know,
Mix it with coffee.
A lot of different
you
things,
have
right?
No idea what the regimens are at a dose that they say in the paper they picked because it just matches the dose that had an effect in vitro kinds of stuff. And then they do these things and they, you know, they report some statistical things. They report these effect sizes and they want to make the case that something is going on. But right when I walked in the studio, you said there was a criticism that you read about this paper. What was that criticism?
I don't remember what I said in the beginning, but I do have a criticism of the paper. It says here that, you know, this is a protein and it's really easily digested by...
We're not even there yet. We're still talking about the paper. We're talking about a paper that has some of the comparisons that they made. And they looked, they measured these testing on this Alzheimer's disease test, 8 days, 30 days, 60 days, and 90 days after taking it. So up to 3 months. Mm-hmm. Right, and they basically compared the experimental group, where people taking this supplement, and the placebo group, where people were not. Any differences that they picked up at didn't show up until after taking it for 90 days, which is sort of interesting. You know, like I said, you don't have the variability here, but their statistics say there were no differences until you got to the 90-day thing. I had a problem with some of the statistics that they did because what it looked to me for some of these things that they were using like paired and independent t-tests kind of stuff to compare these groups. It seems to me that the more appropriate statistical design would have been repeated measures analysis of variance. So I have some criticisms about the statistical things that they actually did. But then again, you know, statistics is not a rule. It's sort of an art, blah, 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 blah. That's another kind of thing. The reason I point all this stuff out is because the effects that they report are very, very modest effects, only in the people on the lower end of the Alzheimer's disease scores, and after 90 days of taking it, right? I'm concerned about that given some of this experimental design stuff, because if you're doing an experiment and you're measuring this stuff, we don't know if they looked at the data all the time after 8 days, 30 days, and 60 days. If you're in this company and you're selling this stuff, you go, holy shit, there's no difference here, dude.
Yeah, you kind of have to spin it so that it looks better.
Well, we don't know. Because if the scientists were not blinded to this and they knew what the people were doing, or the people were told, oh, there's no differences in the group, you know, we're only going to do it in, you know, another 30 days, you know, when you do the test next time, but we have no idea what went on or when they unblinded the study, because it's not in the experimental results. Mm-hmm. All of this leads me to have a lot of question marks about the conclusions in the study, the experimental design, some of the statistics, and the fact that this has not been replicated. Mm-hmm. Right? Repetition or replication is one of the keys.
That's right. There's only one study on this that you could find in all of PubMed, right?
In all of PubMed kinds of stuff.
I mean, so that's about Prevagen. Did you find anything about the actual compound or the protein itself?
I'm not saying it's the only literature. It was the only clinical literature out there that I found. I did find a more recent paper where APO aquarin differentially modulates fear memory in adult age rats, which was sort of interesting. This was a paper from 2020, which again it's a Wisconsin-based group doing it. What they did in this paper was they gave rats this compound, and all I'm going to say about it is what you hinted at in this paper. They didn't feed the rats this compound. What they did was they directly put this calcium binding protein, they infused it into brain regions of the rat, mm-hmm. especially the hippocampus, which is known to be involved in like fear memory in adult age rats. So they basically they injected it in there directly into the brain. Why did they have to do that? Because it's a protein. And there's a problem about proteins. What happens to proteins when you eat them? Hold that thought, Dan. We'll come back to it after our break on Health 411 for brief underwriting announcements. You're listening to 107.7 The Bronx and 107.7thebronx.com.
There's no appointment needed for this doctor's visit. Now back to the all-new Health 411, underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine.
1077 The Bronc, 1077TheBronc.com. Welcome back to Health 411. I'm Professor Jonathan Karp. I'm in the studio with Dan Geller, a student professor, and I'm monologuing to my
student professor.
I'm going to get you talking, student professor. I just want to finish up what I was saying at the end of the last segment. I was talking about a basic science paper involving rats where they basically they put hippocampal infusions directly into the rat's brain, and they looked for changes in fear memory in mm-hmm. these animals. We don't have to go into the data. It was not about cognitive health. It wasn't about brain health. It wasn't about all these sort of things. The bottom line was they directly injected this stuff into the animal's brain. Why is that an issue? It's an issue because they're selling this product, right? Like I said, they're in vitro studies. You put this product on, hippocampal slices of rat brain, and you can change the way the cells respond to something. It means they do it in a dish. They do it if you put it directly in the brain. It doesn't matter. It mean that if you eat the stuff, any of that stuff's going to happen, right? Why can't a type 2 diabetics eat insulin?
Why can't they eat insulin? Yeah, it's broken down in the gut.
Yeah, well, insulin is a protein.
Yes, and right? Proteins are pretty easily
digested.
What
happens
generally?
To the proteins that you eat? So this APO aquarin apparently is a protein. I think it's about 197 amino acids long. It's a protein, decent protein.
Yeah.
And I was doing some reading that says it's broken down by pepsin and digestive enzymes.
90% of it was broken down by pepsin, I think was the number I saw.
Yeah, in how long?
What, less than a minute?
Yeah, like 30 seconds, yeah. Right? And so this is a protein, like most proteins that you eat, that your body breaks down into its component parts and then, you know, uses the amino acids for other things. Mm-hmm. Interesting question. Just like insulin, you can't eat insulin because insulin will be destroyed and never get to the target organs. You want it to work as, you know, as a glucose transporter. Receptors, not going to activate them. So you don't know, right? You got to eat this thing. First of all, you've got to eat enough of it that it survives in your GI tract, survives in your blood, and then will actually get through the blood-brain barrier to your brain if it's going to do anything for brain
health.
I
mean, what can generally traverse the blood-brain barrier? Can proteins like this do that?
No. Proteins can get into amino acids. So you know, the standard way of teaching it is, you know, you eat a big meal at Thanksgiving and people get tired and want to lay on the couch and like watch the Lions play football or something, right? That's because people think, or one of the reasons, is that after you eat a tryptophan-rich meal, tryptophan is a large neutral amino acid, and there's a transporter to get things through the blood-brain barrier. And it now there's more tryptophan, so it's going to compete with other large neutral amino acids for transport into the brain. More tryptophan gets into the brain because there's more of it being transported, and then tryptophan can be made into neurotransmitters that, you know, can change behavior mm-hmm. and things like that. And one of the classic examples, like serotonin, which is a tryptophan derivative, right? As is melatonin as well, because you can tryptophan dope.
A lot of things.
Yeah, a whole bunch of other stuff. And so the idea is that, you know, amino acids can get in. Things that usually get through the blood-brain barrier more easily are gases get in. Things that are very lipophilic get in, like barbiturates can diffuse right in, alcohol. You know, so it doesn't have to be a transport mechanism to get those kinds of things.
It could be passive transport is what you're saying.
Yeah, so diffusion and things like okay. that. Steroids. Right.
So this is more into like my biochemistry.
Yeah, steroids
degree.
Are lipophilic, so steroids diffuse right through and they'll bind to intracellular.
What about opioids? Do opioids?
No, those are proteins. Those are peptides.
Okay.
Right? So even the endogenous opiates, the endorphins, the enkephalins, they're peptides.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the idea is if you eat this stuff, right, how I'd love to see a study, even if you fed it to rats, how much of it actually gets into the brain.
Maybe I could do that study.
Yeah, you could do it. You'd have to get some of this stuff.
Well, yeah.
But you might have to, you know, eat four times your body weight to have it in there. That begs the question. I'm making that up, so I don't really know.
Of course.
But it begs the question, is one of the reasons that they say, oh, it's well tolerated, you know, the minimal side effects, is because you eat it and it gets destroyed.
Yeah, and barely any.
And so there's no side effects.
Yeah,
that is.
I wonder why.
That is a potential criticism, right, of what's going on. You also don't know where it goes. assuming you can get it through the gastrointestinal system, right? You don't know if it goes to the liver and is changed into something else. You don't know if you just pee it out, one pass through the kidneys. You don't know if you just poop it out. You don't know where it goes or what's happening to it. So there's a distribution in the body issue,
yeah.
Especially if you're going to make brain health claims. It begs the question, maybe like some people who take morphine, morphine is changed in, what is it, 6-hydroxymorphine or something like that. And that's what has a lot of the effects.
Right.
So maybe when people eat this thing, it's converted into something else somewhere in the body. And maybe one of the metabolites is having the effect.
Maybe.
Maybe.
That's like psilocybin. Psilocybin isn't the active component.
Right. It's psilocin. Mm-hmm. Great analogy. So those are all the kinds of things that are going on with this thing that you don't know about. You have no idea.
That's an interesting research project for me, though, to figure that out.
It could be if you could get some of this stuff, or even buy the pills. I'm sure the pills are not just pure this stuff. There's other fillers. A whole bunch of other stuff.
That's some organic chemistry right there. Got to extract it. All that fun stuff.
A lot of medicines that are also destroyed by the GI tract have conjugates added to them, mm-hmm, to help them survive. That's why a lot of drugs have an HCl attached to them.
Oh.
It helps protect them in the acidic environment of the sun.
I mean, so combining them with an acidic sort of counter ion?
Yeah, or something like that.
Not counter ion, but how does that protect against digestion?
It helps it helps fold it in a way it doesn't break down.
Okay.
Or something, right? There's also cases. I did see one recent paper in the literature. I didn't print it out, but I did. Did I see it? Oh, nope, I didn't print it out. Where suggested that there might be a way to protect both. It was comparing this protein with calmodulin, another calcium binding protein. And it was a biochemistry paper. And they were suggesting that one way to try to protect it in the body from being degraded was to have it somehow covalently bind to cholesterol. Mm-hmm. And cholesterol could be a carrier for some of these calcium binding.
Oh, so cholesterol can, in general, can cholesterol serve as a carrier? It's not a protein, right? But it could serve as a carrier.
They were suggesting that might be a way of protecting it.
I've never heard of that.
That might be a way of protecting it, at least by its biomedical. This is a biochemistry paper. Had to do with what part of the molecule the calcium actually binds to. Because it's not like one molecule, one calcium ion. Mm-hmm. These things bind 4 to 8 of them. And they were looking at the relative structure of these things. And they were saying, calcium's important for this, that, and the other thing. Wouldn't it be great if we could deliver calcium and control it? And they were suggesting that might be a way to do it. So these are all issues. Getting it in, getting to the target, getting it through the blood-brain barrier are all problems I would have with this compound, and not just this compound. Other compounds as well, If you talk to most dietitians and they talk about supplements, they would say, it's great to have supplements, especially vitamins, minerals, and all these things. But most of the time, what you're really doing is you're putting these extra things in, especially for the water soluble ones. Your body doesn't store them. All you're doing is literally peeing your money away and pooping it away. You know what I mean? And so it'd be interesting to have rats or people take this and measure the urinary outputs, try to find it.
Yeah, that's that, or the, it's metabolite.
All those kinds of questions. You look at the literature and you go, where is it?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
By analogy, you've heard of Rolaids. Tums and Rolaids.
Okay, yeah.
I forget how the story goes. This is a long time ago, but they have magnesium and other things in there, mm-hmm, right? And what one of them found out was that if you didn't put the active ingredient in with, in this thing, your body just peed and pooped it out. It didn't absorb it. So that was a big thing in the business for a while. Is one of them was, our product, you can eat it, but our product's actually absorbed by the body. You just pee and poop the other one out. I would love to see similar studies done with this and a lot of other dietary supplements. And you see where I'm going like this. Unless, how many people do you know that have like night blindness, or how many people do you know with scurvy?
Not very many.
You know, or like I'm picking those are vitamins, but the, you know, the supplement world, if you are healthy and you're doing all the things, your body is going to make all the appropriate things.
I mean, yeah,
that
it takes care of itself. If you just eat right, you know, you have a balanced diet.
And then you have, you know, any website that's just full of testimonials, right? You don't, like you said, you don't know what it is. It could be the person's cousin. You know, you just, you know.
I mean, we don't really consider anecdotal evidence in scientific data.
Well, you can learn from anecdotal evidence if it suggests something that you can actually go out and test and study and eliminate some of these problems.
But a lot of it seems like really subjective.
What do you mean?
Like the testimonials are subjective. It's not like they're just saying, I feel better.
They're not going to put your dad on who says, I took this for a few days and I got headaches.
Yeah, obviously not.
Right?
I mean, listen, medicine's a business.
Well, this company is a business, they might do other things. I don't know. I didn't, you know, don't need to know. But in terms of the science of healthcare, viewing this thing, testimonials are great. They're entertaining. What would you say? If your dad says, "Oh, I want to try it again," what would you say to your dad, Dan?
I mean, listen, you're your own guy. You got it, but it didn't help you last time, so I don't see why I would help you this time. That's what I would say to my dad.
Yeah, save your money.
Save your money.
Cool. Okay, so we're out of time. So this was your idea, Dan.
Dan's idea.
Professor Dan, I need to get you talking more, and I apologize for that. However, we are at the end of the program. This is 107.7 The Bronx and 107.7thebronx.com. We are recording live from the Digital Bronx Studios. Thank you for listening to Health 411. This program is part of Capital Health and Rider University's efforts to bring people together to address issues associated with all aspects of health and healthcare. I hope today's conversation has given you something to think about, not just in terms of the one product we're talking about, but about claims about brain health and other kinds of health that are out there. If you have questions and or comments about this program or want to make suggestions for future broadcasts, please email us at health411@rider.edu.
Remember, you have a doctor's appointment scheduled for every Sunday at 10 a.m. Don't miss the all-new Health 411 with Dr. Jonathan Karp and our expert medical guest from Capital Health. You can listen to Health 411 anytime on demand. Go to 1077thebronx.com/health411 to listen to past episodes or tune in every Thursday at 9 a.m. to hear the weekend rewind edition of Health 411. Health 411 on 1077 The Bronx is underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine. Capital Health is the region's leader in providing progressive quality patient care with exceptional physicians, nurses, and staff, as well as advanced technology.